Actually, I didn't have a very distinguished military career.
But how long did you stay in?
Well, I was too young for the draft. I was 20. The draft was 21. I was there in January. I wasn't 21 until February. So when February came on, I signed for the draft in Hawaii. And they sent me up to Schofield Barracks. I was there a few days. And being the work we were doing at the time, you know, putting these planes together, they said, well, you know, we're going to send you right back. They put me in the reserves, inducted me and everything else, put me in the reserves, sent me back down to the thing. They could have very easily do it as a GI, but I guess we were working as a team, you know. I mean, certain people had certain jobs to do. And so I went back down there. Well, every year then, the next year, when my year was up, you know, they came to us. They came to about a dozen of us and asked if we would stay for another year. And they said, well, I said no at first. I said no. I said I signed up for a year. I'm going to want to go home. And the other fellows felt the same way. So we kind of lived in these homes, and we were all kind of together, you know, four or five homes. And then finally, about six of us decided, well, they told us if they would sign up for another year, they would give us a 30-day leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, you know, to, not from see, Pennsylvania.
See family, at least.
Yeah, yeah, and this was like a year afterwards, you know. And that sounded pretty good, you know. But then we'd have to go back to Fort Lewis and get on another boat and all that and come to Hawaii. So I did that, and then it was 2 years, and then after the third year or something, then it was 44, they kept me in, then I went into service permanently. But I didn't have, like I said, I never killed any Japanese.
So you really spent those 3 years working in Hawaii,
more or less,
on airplane related construction,
yeah,
maintenance,
that and we would go to different islands to, you know, and just a lot of flights, you know, checking planes out. And they would bring squadrons in and stuff like that. And I remember when Roosevelt came there, you know, servicing his plane, you know. So it was kind of interesting. And we also serviced Eddie Rickenbacker's plane. He was the famous World War plane. And his navigator was DeAngelis from New Columbus out here in Niskahoning. And I remember talking to him and everything else, you know. Well, the next day, the plane went down the Pacific someplace, you know. And a lot of these things bothered you after a while, you know. The stress, you know, especially in the beginning, you know. You drank a lot of coffee, you ate a lot of aspirins, and you not have the right sleep and all that.
You felt you had a lot of responsibility.
You did. Well, the stress was something. Sometimes you would get back and say, geez, did I do this? Did I do that? You know, did I forget to do this? You know? And eventually it worked on me. And that's how I wound up in a hospital finally for 6 weeks, you know. And I was, the next ward was the Section 8 ward, you know, just nerves, you know, and stuff like that. Ate a big hole in my stomach, you know, and
this was sort of in 43 or 44?
44. Mm-hmm. It was before the war ended, yeah. And then 5 years, and before the war ended.
So you had an ulcer, did they finally determine?
Well, I think so, yeah, ulcer, whatever it was, you know. The doctor told me it was a rotten stomach. Whatever.
That's
that.
Pretty general.
Yeah. But there was a captain there when I was in the hospital. Well, there were so many things transpired, you know, during the years and all, little incidents and all. But like I said, it was never a question where I had a really distinguished military career or anything like that. I worked myself up to a PFC corporal, and finally, at the end, was a sergeant, you know. But that was much later, when I joined the regular Army then.
So you joined the regular Army, or they activated you? Because you'd already been in
No. When you were a draftee, you were called the Army, the AUS, the Army of the United States. If you were a volunteer, you were an RA, a regular Army, see? So there was a distinction. A lot of people were in the service and they were RAs because they were volunteers, you know. If you were drafted, you were the AUS. You know, I mean, there. When I was in the hospital, I used to watch these people who were in Section 8, you know, the people had really nervous breakdowns and all that. I was at Triplett General Hospital, and I used to look down at them and all, and they would be talking to each other. And the first thing, they would start beating each other, beating each other up, you know. And then it would be broken up and all that. And a couple of days later, they would start again, you know. And it was frightening, you know, to see these people. And, gee, how, you know, I'm glad I'm not down there, because the guy who was next to me, one night he just went off, you know. He started carrying on and everything else and throwing things around and all that. They put him down, and I saw him. I used to watch him down there. He'd be sitting down there by himself, you know. So after watching these people a while and all that, there was a captain there who was treating me and all that. Nice, really nice fella, you know, one of the nice doctors. And he said, oh, George, he said, I told him the whole story, how I got there and what I went through, you know, as far as the stress and things like that. And he said, I'm going to send you home, medical discharge. I said, oh, good. So I waited, and I was, after a while, I started to pick up pretty good, you know, from the rest and everything else. And I started to feel pretty good about everything. And I thought, oh, good. I wrote home, told him I was going to come home and everything else. In the meantime, this guy's transferred, this doctor transferred. I noticed he wasn't coming around. I inquired, and then I found out that he was transferred. They had another doctor came in. He was pretty nice and all that, and they had put in for a medical discharge for me. I went up to this major was sitting in this large room, at ease, you know, after a while, and he said, how are you feeling, soldier? I said, oh, pretty good. I said, I feel much better, which was probably the wrong thing to say. But I did feel better. I said, I feel much better. I said, I could eat again. For a while, I couldn't eat. I got to the point where I couldn't eat anything, you know, and my joints ached, kind of the lingering effects of dengue fever and little malaria and everything else. And it was just a mess. I was like 119 pounds, you know. And I started to pick up a little bit, and he said, well, how do you feel? I said, oh, not bad. I said, I feel much better. So he talked to me a while, and he said, well, step outside a while. And I stepped outside, and I come back in. He said, well, I see you have about 4 or 5 months to go yet. And I said, yeah. He said, well, we're going to keep you in. He said, they took me off the airplanes in the meantime, and they put me in a headquarters company. But all they had to do was go into the headquarters there and not do anything, really. Just trying to recuperate, more or less, you know. And I met a captain there, and one day he came to me. He said, George, he said, I know you like photography. I said, yeah. I said, I like to take the camera, and I used to like to, on my days off, go down to Honolulu or someplace or whatever, take some pictures. And he said, I'm going to Japan. The war was over. The war ended, and a few months later that he came to me. He said, I'm going to Japan. Special services. He said, you want to go? I said, no. No. I said, I have a few months to go. I said, I'm going home. So then he said, if you change your mind, he said, let me know. He said, I could rig up something for you to get a leave back home. He said, you'd have to join the regular army for 18 months. He said, but be a chance for you to see Japan, you know, with the Army occupation. I said, well, I wasn't in a mood, you know. I thought about it for a while, and then we talked a while, and finally one day I said, maybe I will take you up on it. I said, put papers through. And I said, well, will the 30 days be from Hawaii here to home? He said, no. He said, I'll rig it up from Fort Meade, Maryland. So all this other time, with travel time, was on the government's time. So I finally got to Fort Meade, Maryland, got my 30 days, spent a nice 30 days here. It was in the summertime, in June. It's nice summertime, and I spent the time here and went back to Fort Meade. And all on my own then, I had to go cross-country again, go to Fort Washington again, and get a boat there to go to Japan. Mm-hmm. And that's how I wound up in Japan. with the special services, and that's how I became a photographer.
That would have started in 46.
45.
In
45. Late 45, yeah. Late 45, early 46, yeah, you're right. And then I became, there was another fellow that had gone through Lowry Field, through the photography school and all that, and his time was up and all that in the meantime. And I really never went to any photography schools or anything else, but they did change my MOS to a photographer, you know. So they had this lab there. We were doing aerial work and developing aerial film and all that for reconnaissance and things like that. They gave me a speed graphic with film and flash bulbs and all that. And they gave me a Jeep. They gave me a patch. I was able to get in off-limit places. And I had, for 18 months, I had a pretty good experience, you know. I was able to learn a little about the speed graphic and how to use it. And sometimes someone from the Air Force would be coming into Yokohama on a ship or something like that, and they would send me down to get pictures of them getting off, you know, or a meeting or something like that. And I never did any combat work because the war was over and all that, but it was a good experience for me. We did some aerial work, you know.
So this was really your training, your formal training. This occurred then. So you've done really just some personal photography.
Yeah, I had a Jeep, you know, and all that, and I was able to roam around Japan. You know, I had, you know, gas and everything else. I would go off in the off-limit places. This one instance, I went to. I didn't have the Jeep then. I took the train. The train travel was the only way you could get around Japan. You know, they had. Everybody, if you want to go to 100 miles or something, you know, you thought nothing of it, you know, you get on the train and try to get some rice or something. The Japanese people. So this one day I got on the train and I got lost, you know. I really got lost. I got confused of where I was and all that. I had the camera with me and I had some sea rations and stuff like that. And I was just didn't know where I was because I was in an off-limits place. There was no GIs, no people around. And it was getting dusk, and I had pulled into this, I got off at this one railroad station, and when I did, all these Japanese people just circled me, you know, completely around, and I'm trying to tell them where Johnson Air Base. Well, they didn't know what, they couldn't understand English, you know, and I couldn't make myself, so finally I walked off to the side, and some kids started to follow me, and I sat down in the stoop. Pulled out some sea rations and they were looking at me and all that. So finally, I threw the rations at them and they grabbed the rations, you know, and started eating on. And I figured, well, I can't stay here, you know. So I got back on the train and I rode those trains all night, different trains. It would stop, I'd get on another one. People were getting on in the early morning. I remember getting the Japanese were getting on with chickens and pigs and everything else going to some market, I guess, you know. Finally, in the morning, I got off and I run into an MP and I wasn't too far away, maybe like 50 or 60 miles, but I had been gone in circles all night long, you know. Finally, I got back to the base and being as I had the lab and all that, no, I was more or less my own boss too. I had about three Japanese working for me then who used to clean up the place, mix chemicals and stuff like that. Two of them were good. The other one was a former officer who felt he was still in the Japanese army and all that, and every now and then we would find things missing or stuff like that. So I mentioned to the MPs and all that, you know, we were having, and they caught him one day stealing things, and they beat the daylights out of him, that's all. And so that was the end of him. I had another fellow, someone named Watanabe, who was very, we became pretty good friends, you know. I wasn't too happy with the Japanese for the things they had done, and, you know, to the Americans, a lot of the, especially the prisoners and things like that in the early part of the war. And it took me a while to really get used to them and all that. But this guy was, he would speak in broken English too, you know, about his family and how the trouble he was having getting food to them and things like that. And I even got to the point where I would get things out of the mess hall canned things, and I would slip them to him and all that, and so he could take them home and all that. He would tell me about going 200 miles up to the northern part of Japan on a weekend and all that to get rice, you know, and stuff like that. Yeah, I guess we're all human beings after a while, you know. We kind of, you get compassion for people, especially when they're off in the distance, and so you figure, so what, and all that, when they tell you these stories and all that. And there were just like people in this country, I mean, you were told to do certain things and you did them, you know. It was just this minority up at the top who decided to declare war and all that. And then the ordinary people have to suffer for it, you know. So I used to slip them some food every now and then. And it's a funny thing. When I was ready to go back, I was there almost a year and a half. And I became pretty good friends with him and other people there, some Japanese and all that. And there were some people who had converted to Christianity and all that, and they had their own services there, you know. So I used to go, then I started to go there a little, you know, every now and then I would drop in, you know. All during the time I was in the Pacific, I never went to church or anything like that. I never went to a mass. I went by hundreds of masses being sold in a field or something like that, or in a hangar or something like that, and I never bothered to stop. I would go right by it, you know. But when I got out to Japan, things, I started to see things a little differently and all that, you know. And I would now and then, it wasn't a Catholic service, it was a Christian service. I would stop in when they would have it. I would just sit there, you know. When I was ready to go back, he came in with a nice case, like for jewelry, and he wanted me to have it. And I asked him what it was. He said, open the pearls. I opened up, it was a hand-cultured set of pearls that had been in the family for hundreds of years, in her family. And he wanted to give it to me, and I didn't want to take it. And finally, he insisted. We didn't have any lockers in this base I was at. It was a place called Irmagawa. It was where the Japanese trained their kamikaze pilots. So it was a kind of a Spartan camp. It was just plain wooden barracks, had a false ceiling, and every night the rats would run up and down the ceiling. You could see where they did their droppings and everything else, and they would have a race up and down the false ceiling, you know. So it was a kind of a Spartan camp, and we had no lockers. We had barracks bags. That's all we had for our clothes, and all your possessions were in this barracks bag. If you had a camera, you carried it with you, because it would be stolen, you know. I couldn't carry the pearls with me, so I thought, well, if I wrap them in a lot of clothes and all that, and put them in the bottom of my bag or something like that, no one's going to find them, you know, because they used to go around and tap the barracks bags, these guys, you know, and if they would. GIs, you know, if you were gone for the day or something like that, they were into the black market, and anything they could get to sell, they would do it. And one day I decided I was going to check on these pearls, and I came back and they were gone. Someone stole them. I never told Watanabe, but they were gone. But I guess he always felt I had them, but I didn't have the heart to tell him. When I would have some free time, I had a roller cord. I picked up a roller cord, a twin lens reflex, a German camera. Being that the Germans and the Japanese were allies, they were trading among themselves, so they were still able to pick up some good German camera, the Japanese, you know, like the early Leicas and the Rolleiflexes. And I didn't smoke at the time, so every week we got a carton of cigarettes, you know. And you couldn't keep them in the barracks and all that because they would be stolen, you know. So I knew the head cook, the chef, and I was kind of nice to him. I'd make some prints for him and stuff like that and give them to him and all that. And he would give me this carton of cigarettes every week as a ration. And I asked him if he could keep them for me, you know. And he said, sure, he kept in the mess hall, I'll keep an eye on them. So after I got about 20 cartons of cigarettes, and I was 3 or 4 months before I was going to go back home, and I knew I was going to, you know, my time was up, I figured I'm going to get me a Rolleiflex, which is, you know, the top of the line, you know. I mean, I'm going to be sitting on the top of the world here with a Rolleiflex. So I packed up the 20 carton of cigarettes in the barracks bag and got on the train, and I didn't want to go into Tokyo itself. I went to a suburb of Tokyo called Ueno. And I got off there, and I was walking down the street, and I saw a Rolleiflex in the window. And I quick darted into the shop and showed the cigarettes, and he agreed, you know, to give me the camera, took the camera out of the window and gave me the camera. It was a standard Rolleiflex. The standard Rolleiflex had little levers on the side where the automatic had little wheels. The newer one that designated your f-stops and your shutter speed. And I walked down the street and I see an automatic in a window. So I quick darted back to another store, got my cigarettes back, gave him the camera. He was upset, you know. But I got the cigarettes back and I got the Rolleiflex. Well, I guarded that Rolleiflex with my life. And then I had a little more time then, so I used to go down the streets of Tokyo, and that's how I started to photograph the people on the streets of Tokyo with this. I couldn't get any film for the Rolleiflex, but what I would do is get some aerial film, and I had some old, the paper backing, and I would go in the dark room, I'd cut the aerial film, and I would tape the film onto the backing as a, it was, because it was kind of flexible. The aerial film is almost, it was a little thicker than regular film, but I was able to roll a piece of it, you know, like 12 exposure onto this thing, and that way I had film for my Rolleiflex, you know. I had film for the 4x5 Speedgraphic, but it was much easier to taking pictures on the streets with the Rolleiflex, so I did that.
So the Rolleiflex is anticipating 35 millimeter. It's getting a little bit closer to that size.
Well, before the 35, see, the early films weren't as good as they are today, the 35 millimeter. They were grainy, and you could blow them up to 5x7 or something like that, you know. And the lenses were faster. But the Rolleiflex had a real good lens, like a Tessar lens and all that. The film was bigger. So therefore, you didn't have to blow up your pictures as big, you know, from the bigger negative. After the war, people weren't shooting, the magazines and all that weren't shooting 35. They were all shooting Rolleiflex, 2 1/4. People like Fritz Henley and all that, they were all doing things with 2 1/4 square. And when Rose worked for Holiday, she had about 3 or 4 Rolleiflex. I still have 3 of her Rolleiflexes yet that she gave me. She worked with Rolleiflexes because the negative was bigger. You get a bigger piece of color later on too, so it helped in the reproduction, you know. And the Leica really didn't come into being until about 10 days after, 10 years after, during the Korean War, when David Douglas Duncan and a number of other photographers started to use the 35 millimeter during the Korean War. There was some used in World War I by Eugene Smith and all of it, not much. A lot of it, most of the good work was done with 4x5 Speedgraphics, like Joe Rosenthal's picture of Iwo Jima. That was done with a 4x5 Speedgraphic. But that's how I got into photography, and I got so, it just seemed to grow in me, this that I had to take pictures. It never seemed like I was happy or anything unless I was taking pictures or, you know, with the camera and all that. And I spent all my time then, you know, my spare time in Tokyo taking pictures of the people and all that. That's how I accumulated, you know, a pretty good sizable group of pictures of the people at
So
that time.
were you able to bring back the negatives as well as
Yeah,
the
yeah, I,
prints?
we had trouble with the mail and things getting lost and all that, so Another incident when I was taking pictures for the, you know, for the lab, for the job I had, I got a note once from our commander for our base there that a general had requested that they send a photographer down to Tokyo at this certain date that the Emperor of Japan was having a birthday party for his son, Prince Akihito, which he was 8 years old at the time, and he was inviting members of the military government to this party in the Imperial Palace in Japan. They had a moat around it, you know. People that worked there in the Imperial Palace, they worked there and they weren't allowed to leave. They were like prisoners there, you know. They had to work there, and so very few people from the outside world had a chance to really get into the Imperial Palace, and here I am going to see the Imperial Palace. Well, I got in there, and they had this, went across the moat, went into this huge room, and they had the emperor there, and they had the boy, and of course, I had to take pictures with this general. I knew who he was, General Burns. I had to take pictures of him and group and all that. And there was a kind of a session there for pictures and all that. And then the first thing you know, they were going to retire to the dining room and all that, which I wasn't invited to, and I had to leave. But I did get pictures there, and I was in there for maybe an hour or so, or 45 minutes, an hour. So I did get into the Imperial Palace.
So you went back and you developed those?
Yeah, then I went back to the base, made prints and all that, blew them up to 8x10 and gave them, and they were real happy with them and all that. There were nothing really, you know, group shots, people standing around and things like that. A lot of military people. I understand MacArthur was going to be there also, but he wasn't at this thing. He was at the dinner, at the seating. But I never saw him. I did see MacArthur many times coming out of the Daiichi building, which was the headquarters for the Army of Occupation, you know. And he would, you know, I would be there with the camera, and I have pictures somewhere of him, you know, coming out of the building and all that. And
so about how many photos or prints or negatives did you eventually bring back with you?
I say I have about 300-500 negatives. I never really counted them. From those, I would say I have about 50 or 60 that I really blew up and all that, and that I thought are well worthwhile. But about 4 months before I was ready to come home, there was I had got word that there was a bad train wreck, a Japanese train wreck, maybe about 20 miles away. And I went up to the commander, you know, and I asked him if I go. He said, sure, go on up, see what's going on, you know. So I got in the Jeep and took my speed graphic and all that, took the camera up, and when I got up there, evidently this train, it was the Japanese at the time, they had just wooden cars. The only thing that was metal on was the undercarriage and the wheels, and the rest was all wood, you know. It'd been coming down the side of this mountain, and when it got down near the bottom, there was a turn. And when it turned, evidently they went off the tracks and all that, and all these things went down this embankment and all that, and all these metal things, and they were packed. If you ever saw these trains, they were just completely packed. They come down on top of these Japanese and all that and just squashed them to death, a lot of them and all that. By the time I got there, they were starting to lay them out in the fields, you know, pull them out of the wreckage and lay them down in the fields, putting them in rows and things like that. And I took some pictures of them. I started taking pictures of them, you know, and I looked for, even then I started to look for the human interest. I just didn't want bodies, and I looked for people or something like that with their arms around a corpse or something like that, or picking one up or something like that, or putting them in. They had these little buggies with the one wheel in the front and two in the back, you know, and then they would lay them in a buggy and pull them away or something like that. I didn't know what to do with the pictures. I came back, I developed them, and you know, they looked good and all that. And you know, as far as it's 156 people, you know, laying out in the field, you know, it's a lot of people. So I didn't know what to do with them, and when I was in Tokyo once, I had gone into the AP office just as curiosity, you know. And there was a guy named Russell Brines there who was head of the AP Bureau, and I took the negatives in and took some prints in, and it was the next day, you know, I went right in. And he was liked the pictures a lot, you know, and he said, you know, can we use them? I said, sure, why not, you know. So they, I don't know where they, I never saw any in print, but he used them. I never got anything for them because they weren't actually... They were from the government, you know. I mean, I was still, you know, I was still in the service. But I took them into them, and the military had no use for them. They weren't in military. It was strictly a civilian thing, so they didn't care. So I got to know him pretty good. Russ, I used to stop in later on. I would every now and then would stop in. And one day he said, how would you like to stay here? Join our AP. I said, no. Nah. I said, I'm going home. I said, I've been out here a long time, you know, since January of 42. And this was June. Well, this was about April of 47 already. And I said, nah, I'm going home. I had sent some pictures. I decided then I was going to either go into journalism or go into photography somehow along the line. And I had sent some pictures into the Art Center School into Los Angeles. They wanted to see six pictures or something like this, work he had done in the past. So I sent them in, corresponded with a while. I got a letter back, and I told them that I would be coming, he'd been discharged, you know, in June. And they said, well, why don't you stop in the center? So I did. I got in. When I was discharged at Fort Hamilton, and I went down to Los Angeles, and I went to the school, and I thought, oh boy, this is going to be neat, you know. I'm going to school, finally get some instruction and everything else. And I thought, well, I'll go on home. They said they'll take me after Labor Day. This is June. I thought, I'll go home for a couple of months, and I'll start in the school in September. But anyway, Russell, he was kind of disappointed, and I often wondered, you look back, and you know, I mentioned about Rose, what would have happened if we would have stayed in Europe, and I said, what would happen if I would have stayed in Japan, you know? You make certain decisions, you know, and later on you look back and you say, why did I do that? I mean, what prompted me to do that? And I guess sometimes you don't even think. I guess you think, I'm going to do a certain thing, and you make up your mind and you do it, that's all. Probably if I hadn't contacted the Art Center School or something like that and was thinking about that, I probably would have taken a job, you know. I probably would have. Probably would have wound up in Korea, you know, because the Korean War started after that. And that's when the Japanese started to manufacture some lenses again. It was like, took them 10 years, but they started to manufacture some Nikkor lenses and all that. And one day, Duncan put this Japanese lens, this Nikkor lens, on a Leica body, and they sent, he was working for Life magazine at the time, they sent the negatives back to New York, and they couldn't imagine why the things were so clear, you know, everything was so, I mean, sharp and everything else, so they wanted to know what was going on. And then he finally, that the Japanese, when they were making these, decided to try them out on some American photographers, and so they gave them these lenses to try as to see how they would work. They're worth thousands of dollars now, these lenses. They're the early ones, you know, and the early Nikon F, you know, the rangefinder thing. A good Nikon F now will run you about $10,000 or $12,000, just the body, you know. They made very few of them. It was a well-designed camera, a little bigger than the Leica camera, a little boxier, you know, not around, but very, very efficient. It was more built on the German Contax than the Leica. And that's how the Japanese broke into the camera market, which they practically dominate now. All the good cameras, even the Leica cameras, they're good now. They're still, some are made in Germany, but most of them are good cameras are made in Japan now.